Before we begin this evening's shiur, just want to mention that Im Yirtzeh Hashem, next week we will not be having a shiur. I'll be in Chutz Laaretz, in the United States, traveling for the yeshiva. And beginning with this week, actually, if anyone is in Far Rockaway on Wednesday evening, in the White Shul there'll be a shiur, and also on Sunday evening in Tinek, in the Beth Abraham Shul as well. They will have details there, but we'll not be making it back from Monday evening this time next week, and therefore we'll pick up again in 2 weeks' time when the palachic jet lag will have sorted itself out and everyone will be on the same parsha, which is Parshas Pinchas. But in the meanwhile, our attention is devoted to the parsha of Chukas, and Chukas begins, as we know, with the Parah Aduma, many, many laws, how it's prepared, exactly what happens with it, who does what and where and how. And we, of course, look at the Parah Aduma as the quintessential chok. Ostensibly, it's a mitzvah about which we don't really know what to say. But having said that, a lot is said about it. And let us try and see how we can address the issue and get some type of insight into the Parah Aduma. And we will be guided, as we have been so many times lately, by the Ben Melech, Rav Leib Mintzberg. And he begins by referring to a medrash. And as we know, we'll just read the pasuk so that everything is clear in front of us. This is the beginning of Perik Yud Tes. So Pasuk Beis is Zos Chukas HaTorah, it's called the Chok of the Torah, Asher Tziva Hashem Neymor, Da'aber Abnei Yisrael, V'yikru Elecha, let them take to you Parah Aduma, a red cow or heifer, as we say, Temima, perfect, full, Asher Ein Bamum, which has no blemish, Asher Lo Ala Aleha Ol, that no yoke has ever been on this animal. But these are the specifications for the Parah Aduma. It has to be red, without blemish, never had a yoke on it. The Medrash states that all of these terms are allusions to the four exiles, and in fact the four plus one exiles, because it begins with Mitzrayim itself. Parah, says the Medrash, Ze Mitzrayim. We don't often have Mitzrayim on the list. We look at Mitzrayim as the root of which the four are branches, but here it's number one. Parah is Mitzrayim. It cites a pasuk, Egla Yefeifiyah Mitzrayim. Aduma, red, that's the exile of Bavel. We know Nebuchadnezzar in the statue, he was the head of gold. Gold and red always associated with each other. So Aduma is the first of our subsequent exiles to Bavel. Temima, full, is Paras. Asher Ein Bamum, which has no blemish, that's Yavan, that's Greece. We assume a nod towards the emphasis on physical perfection and lack of blemish in Greece. And Lo Ala Aleha Ol, no yoke has ever arisen upon it, says the Medrash, that's Rome. Rome does not accept the yoke of anyone, certainly not Ol Malchus Shamayim. At any rate, of course, each of these associations needs and deserves to be pondered in its own right, how these terms check out with those exiles. But in the general sense, we see that these specifications for the Parah Aduma somehow are expanded into representations of the four exiles. And the question is, what does one have to do with the other? In Pasuk Tes of our Perek, and again to read the Pasuk, we're in the middle, but V'asaf ish tahor es efer hapara, a pure man, someone who's tahor, he shall gather the ashes of the parah once it's been burnt, ve'niach michutz la'machane b'makom tahor, should keep them outside the machane in a pure place, Vaisala Adas Bnei Yisrael, Lemishmeres, Lemeini Dar, should be a safekeeping, should be guarded there. Lemeni da waters of sprinkling, chatosi. The para is referred to in this pasuk test as a chatos. What does the word chatos mean here? And of course, the background is that we're familiar with the concept of chatos. It's a sin offering. Para aduma is not a sin offering. It's not an offering at all. It's an animal, but it's not a korban. The blood is not sprinkled on the mizbeach, and nothing happens in the premises of the Beis HaMikdash, so it's not any type of korban, and certainly not the specific type of korban that we call a chatos, but we see that it's called a chatos. What are we to make of this? Rashi comments, and Rashi says, Lashon chitui kipshuto. The word chatos, do not associate that with the sin offering. This isn't that. It's an expression of chitui. Chitui means to remove something, because it removes tuma. And therefore, that's what the para aduma is doing. We know that's what the para aduma does when the water with the ashes sprinkled into it, or mixed into it, is sprinkled on the onto the person, so that he becomes tahor. That's called chitui, removing his tahara. That's the pshat, says Rashi. That's lefi pshuto. But then says Rashi, ulefi hilchosov. But in terms of the halachas of the para aduma, we note kara hakosuv chatos. The Torah has called it a chatos, which is very interesting. Firstly, by the way, I think this is correct. One can, of course, always good to go through Rashi one more time. But I think this is the only place where Rashi introduces something with the expression lefi hilchosov, according to its halachas, as opposed to lefi pshuto. Normally, the counterpart to pshuto is lefi midrasho, or rabbeinu darshu. You have pshat and the drash. Here, you have the basic meaning is pshuto, which is removing tuma. And then the other way of looking at it is lefi hilchosov, based on its halachas. It's called a chatos. And this, once again, is a classic interplay between pshat and drash. The word chatos doesn't have to mean a sin offering, but it for sure raises that association. And therefore the pshat is not bound by the fact that chatos means a sin offering everywhere else. It can still mean removing tumah here. But the drash says, yeah, but isn't it interesting? Isn't it noteworthy that the very same term, there's another message coming up. And there's halachas that are derived from here. Says Rashi, Lomar Shukakochim. It is really considered like a korban. In its halachos, which means, for example, Rashi gives one example, Lehi Aser Bahana, it's forbidden to get benefit from it, which is true for korbanos. It's also true, by the way, and this the Sifrei says, another halachic emanation, is that if one shechted the para aduma, not for the sake of para aduma, it's posel, like a korban. And in fact, by the way, for those that did the Daf Yomi and Zvachim recently, they'll know that most korbanos are actually kosher. But a chatas is posel, and it's called a chatas. So interestingly, lefi hilchosov, the para aduma is more like a korban than most korbanos. At least in the sense that if it was the shechita happened without the para aduma in mind, not for the sake of para aduma, it's possible. But where does this lead us? Because the fact remains, it's not a korban. There's no way that it's a korban. And yet, it has the laws of korbanos and the status of korbanos. Where do we have such a hybrid concept, and what are we to make of it? And the truth is, this blended relationship between the para aduma and korbanos and the Beis HaMikdash goes further. As we mentioned, nothing about the para aduma takes place on the premises of the Beis HaMikdash. That's true. But it is also true that when the blood is sprinkled, it's sprinkled in the direction of the Beis HaMikdash, as Pasuk Dalet says, once they've shechted the para aduma, v'lokach el azar kohen midama be'etzpa'o, he takes some of the blood, v'yizah el nochach p'nei ohel moed, he then sprinkles it in the direction of the Ohel Moed, which is the Mishkan, seven times. So much so that the Gemara actually says that there was a place in the wall between Harazesim, where they would do the Paraduma, and the Beis HaMikdash. If the wall was too high that it obstructed view of the Beis HaMikdash, the wall was lower at that point, so there should be visual contact between the place where they did the mitzvah of Parah Adumah. They should be able to see the Beis HaMikdash. Nochach Pesach HaBayis. So once again, it's no and yes. It's not in the Beis HaMikdash, but it's apropos of the Beis HaMikdash, connected to. So what does this mean? And also, it specifically has to be done by a Kohen, like a Korban. As much as we say, and we do say, that the Parah Adumah is not a Korban, yet we find that the Gemara ascribes kapara qualities to it, atonement to it. Where does this come out? It's a Gemara in Moed Katan, Daf Kavches, because the Gemara notes the juxtaposition between the section of Parah Adumah, which is all of Perek Yotes, and the next thing we're going to meet in the beginning of Perek Kaf is the death of Miriam. And the Gemara wants to know why the Torah put these two things together. They were not simultaneous to each other. The Parah Adumah we have already from year at least two, and possibly year one, probably, in the Midbar. Miriam dies 40 years later, or in the 40th year, and we don't really know what happens in between in those 38 years. Nothing that the Torah talks about. So these two episodes didn't happen one after the other, not directly after the other, but the Torah puts them one after the other. To teach you, says the Gemara, that just like the Parah Adumah is Mechaper, so too is the death of Tzadikim Mechaper. So here we have it. The Gemara has told us that the Parah Adumah is Kapara. Once again, sounds like a Korban, even though it's not a Korban. Another point of connection between Parah Adumah and the world of Korbanos, and a very specific Korban again, is the connection between Parah Adumah and Yom Kippur. They both have the following very interesting feature in common, and that is that whoever performs the mitzvahs of either Parah Adumah or Yom Kippur needs to be separated from everyone for a period of 7 days of solitude and preparation before engaging in those things. We know this famously with regards to Yom Kippur. That's how Maseches Yuma begins, Shivas Yomim, 7 days before they separate the Kohen, Gadol from his home, and he's absolutely locked in to the Avodah that is coming. But exactly the same thing is said in the Mishnah in Maseches Parah in the beginning of the third Perek with regards to Parah Adumah. In fact, the Gemara in the beginning of Yuma brings in this Mishnah in Parah and explains that both of these sets of 7 days are derived from exactly the same place. Where? The seven preparatory days of the Miluim. In Parshas Tetzaveh, when they're told that there should be the seven preparatory days and ready for the eighth day, the Pasuk says, Ka'asher asa bayom hazeh, just as it was done on this occasion, Ka'asher asa tziva Hashem lasos lechaper aleichem. Hashem is likewise commanded to do, to atone. What's to do and what's to atone? Says the Gemara, to do, lasos, is Parah Adumah. Lechaper is Yom Kippur. So we see that, and it sounds like it's a din d'oraisa, just like the 7 days of the Miluim before the Mishkan started, another two sets of 7 days, they're both connected to each other because they both come from the same source. But what does Parah Adumah have in common with Yom Kippur? So it's a kind of a complex picture that's emerging. At the end of the day, tachlis, we know, the one thing we know for sure, what Parah Adumah does, it purifies a person from Tumas Mes. But even then, Reb Mintzberg points out something very interesting. Most of the discussion of Para Aduma has already happened before we even talk about someone becoming Tommy. There's a whole discussion, a whole description from the beginning of Perek Yutes, Veshachat and Vavilakach and Behizah, and they're burning and so on. And that goes for the first 10 psukim. The first 10 psukim describe the Para Aduma. Whatever happens to it happens. The first we hear about anyone using it is in Pasuk Yud Aleph, Hanogeh b'meisav l'nefesh adam. If a person comes into contact with the deceased, he's going to be tummy for 7 days, and he needs to use the Para Aduma. But the whole order seems to be reversed, as if to say, what is Para Aduma for? To be metayer, someone who's tummy. So start with the situation. For purposes of comparison, if someone is a metzora, they need the whole thing with the two birds. But it starts with them being a metzora. The Torah doesn't just describe, take two birds and do the following with them. And if someone has tzaras, he will use them. It starts with the situation that warrants this. But here, it's completely backwards. The first 10 psukim, not a word is spoken about the situation that requires the Para Aduma. It sounds like it has its own destiny. A self-contained value of everything that is happening with this Para Aduma. And it's also true that if a person is Tomei, he will use the water. But that's not the be-all and end-all, and it almost sounds like it's not the raison d'etre of the Para Aduma. It's self-contained. But what does that mean? The Medrash, coming back to associating the Para Aduma with other things, the Medrash actually describes it as a rectification of the Chet HaEgel. Rashi cites this, it's from Bamidbar Rabbah. Famously, it gives the mashal, the child made a mess in the king's palace, and they said, let the mother come. Tavo ha'em u'tikaneach tzoas habet. Let the mother come, she'll clean up the mess of the child. So we see that there's a specific connection between Para Aduma and the Chet HaEgel. Now, it cannot be exclusive in nature for the simple reason that we received the Para Aduma even before the Egel happened. We received the Para Aduma in Mara, according to the Gemara. As much as what we might say, Hashem is Makdim Refuah Lamaka, and so on. So it sounds, once again, it's associated with the Chet HaEgel, but it preceded it. It sounds like that's certainly not the be-all and end-all of the Para Aduma. Says Rav Mintzberg, we may use this expression, as surely as in the mashal, it's the mother who's rectifying the sin of the child. Para Aduma is about the mother of sin, the mother of all sin. Sin is an act, but it has forces that lead to it, forces of evil, of wickedness, that lead to wicked deeds. Those forces are the mother, and they beget actions. They bear actions. And the Para Aduma comes to address the root. The Para Aduma comes to address the mother of all of those actions. Where do they come from? What are the wrong perspectives and the drives and so on? And now we understand why the Medrash associates every characteristic of the Para Aduma with another one of the exiles. The exiles of the Jewish people are not just, quote-unquote, trying circumstances, difficult circumstances. They lead the Jewish people to confront a nation that subscribes and has made an ideology, a corrupt ideology, out of whatever it may be, pleasure or knowledge or power. Each one, Bavel and Yavan, and so on. And therefore, the forces of evil, the tendency to take a wrong turn, which at root are forces, ultimately become nations, because they become the credo of whether it's Babylon or Persia or Greece or Rome. So that's the ultimate, one could say, manifestation and embodiment of these forces. Nations that subscribe to them and bow to them. And thus we say, as many Mefarshim point out, the cow is red, which most Korbanos are not, but red is always the color of sin. Im yuchatechim kashanim, kashelev yabin, im yadimu katola, red is always represents wrongdoing. The burning of the red cow, the burning of the Parah Aduma and reducing it to ash, has the cosmic effect of mitigating and lessening and diminishing and reducing all of those forces which are the mother of sin, of sinful deeds. And that is the value of the Parah Aduma for itself. And we can begin to understand now how it is like a korban. Because in the same way that a korban addresses a sinful act, the Parah Aduma addresses the forces that lead to that sinful act. And now, generally speaking, anything that relates to the realm of kapara, of atonement, and so on, addressing matters of sin, always takes place in the Beis HaMikdash. That's where a korban chatos will be offered. However, there are certain situations where there is such a concentration, there's such a suffusion of wrongdoing that it is deemed not appropriate that this is dealt with on the hallowed premises of the Beis HaMikdash. If it's an isolated act, it can be absorbed and rectified within the holy territory of the Beis HaMikdash. But if it's something which is so evil laden, it still needs to be dealt with. It is more appropriate for that to be dealt with off location, still connected, still apropos, but this is not something that's not, at the risk of oversimplifying, it's not chavadik, or it's not appropriate for the Beis HaMikdash itself to have so much evil there. Let it be dealt with somewhere else. What is a classic example of this? This Sa'ir Mishtalech. The goat that is sent away off a cliff on Yom Kippur, that's not a normal way of dealing with sin. That's not a standard situation. But that Sa'ir is actually, it is a korban. But it's not dealing with an isolated, unintentional act, as most korban chatos are. It's dealing with the subtotal. It carries with it, so to speak, the subtotal of every sinful act of the Jewish people over that year, both unintentional, both yes intentional. It has such a concentration of wrongdoing there, the Torah says, this is not to be dealt with in the Beis HaMikdash. Let it be dealt with off-premises. Of course, it maintains a connection, otherwise it wouldn't be a korban. It maintains a connection with the Beis HaMikdash in that it is a twin korban together with the other sa'ir. Right? The two of them. One is actually entirely brought as a korban. And this, therefore, you have this complex situation whereby it's represented as a korban by the other goat. But this one, it's sent away. That much sin, deal with it outside. Lahavta, we can almost resonate with this as there are certain things that a person will be prepared to deal with here, whether it's in court or wherever, and there's other things which are, it's so fraught, it just has to be taken outside. Lahavdil, so to speak. And the same is true with the Parah Aduma. In the same way that the Parah, it's very much like the Sa'ir HaMishtaleach. It's not dealing with this problem or that problem. It's dealing with the mother of all problems, with those forces, which are many and powerful. In order to deal with them and to diminish them, likewise, it's not a regular korban. It has its own relationship with the Beis HaMikdash, but it's not a korban because it doesn't actually deal with the sin that a person did per se. Certainly not Ladoros. Maybe the first one was just after the Egel, but therefore it's all also done, performed outside the Beis HaMikdash. But now we understand why it has so much in common with the Avodah of Yom Kippur. They both need the 7 days of preparation because something so big is about to happen, it cannot even be allowed to take place on the premises of the Beis HaMikdash in terms of the evil that it is confronting and dealing with. Now, what does all of this have to do with the halachas of the Parah Adumah, which we said it purifies people from Tumas Meis? The forces of evil in the world are what allows death into the world, starting with the very beginning, the very first sin, and coming back again with the Egel. We've mentioned many times, the Gemara says in Maseches Avodah Zarah, Daf Hei, and Erevin, Daf Nun Dalet, that had we not fallen at the time of the Egel, so we would have been above death. Ani Amarti Elohim Atem, Uvnei Elyon Kulchem, says Hashem. That's how you should have been. Achein ke Adam tamusin, but in the end you die like man, like Adam, like the original Adam. That's a reference to the Chet HaEgel. That's from the Shir Shoyom for Tuesday. And therefore, if there's any one sin that the Parah Adumah does address, it's going to be the Chet HaEgel, only because the Egel allowed entry back into all of those forces that we were almost beyond their reach, almost there. And the Egel brought us back in, and then death came back into the world as a result of that. So if there's any one event that we would associate with the Parah Adumah, it's going to be the Chet HaEgel. But the Parah Adumah is about more than the Chet HaEgel. But certainly we understand how once the Parah Adumah has been reduced to ash, it will help purify a person from Tumas Meis. Because the diminishing and the reducing of those forces of evil is itself a step against what those forces bring, the death of those forces bring, and certainly at this stage it can remove Tumas Meis. But even before someone is Tameh, and even if no one ever uses the water of the Parah Adumah with the ashes, etc., the goal has already fundamentally been fulfilled. What's represented through addressing the forces of evil through the burning of the Parah Adumah, that is already a self-contained fulfillment. And it's for that reason that some of the ashes needs to be in the Beis HaMikdash the whole time. Rav Mintzberg suggests as long as the ashes are there, the kapara continues. Because the kapara comes from the presence of the ashes. As if to say, it begins with the producing of the ashes from this impressive red cow. But it continues as long as the ashes are there. And what's very interesting is, further, and he has a lot more to say, but in terms of what we are bringing from him, we are almost done. But as we can see, very, very profound understanding and approach, springing together so many things that we may have met them in an isolated sense with the four exiles and so on, and the Chet HaEgel, but to have this unifying vision of what it is. The Rambam says further, it's a well-known idea, and it's codified by the Rambam in Hilchos Parah Adumah. There will, in history, be 10 Parah Adumahs. Rambam says this in the Halachas, which is very interesting, because why is this a Halacha? Does that mean that there should never be 11? Is that why it's a Halacha? As long as there have only been 9, one should look for the 10th. It's very interesting that this is a Halacha at all. But the Rambam says, 9 of them we've already had. And interestingly, the first one of Moshe Rabbeinu lasted until the time of Ezra. And then they went through another 8 in the time of the second Beis HaMikdash, bringing the total to 9. And we're waiting for the 10th. Says Rav Mintzberg, since when does the number of Parah Adumahs make a difference? As if to say, if people are Tomei, you need a Parah Adumah. If there's no one Tomei, you don't need it. If they are, you do need it. How many? However many you need. Why is it of the essence there should be 10? But once we understand that the Parah Adumah is its own enterprise as being mechaper and helping alleviate the forces of evil in the world, so there's 10 of them because 10 is a number of shleimus, and that now becomes a complete series. And moreover, Rav Mintzberg suggests that even though we had the ashes from Moshe's Parah Aduma, and they stayed, as far as we know, they stayed as long as they did. But if you find another Parah Aduma, you should still do it, because there's more to do. There's more to another round in the battle, or another level in confronting and trying to reduce the kokos of Tumah. And moreover, and with this he concludes, Rambam says very interestingly, the idea that some of the ashes should remain in the Beis HaMikdash is true not only for the original Parah Aduma ash of Moshe Rabbeinu, but for all subsequent ones as well, which is very interesting, because what that means is that each one is adding another layer. Let that remain, and it's cumulative, and it keeps going until we wait for the tenth and final Parah Aduma, which will lead to the eradication of all the kokos of Tumah completely. So as I say, I opened this up on Shabbos. I was not expecting to see any of this. It's very, very thought-provoking, challenging, I think, as well. But these are the comments of Leib Mintzberg. Never shies away from presenting the crux of the matter as he sees it, and as always, backed up with the relevant psukim and Ma'amari Chazal. So we move on from there to, from year one, we move on to year 40, to the Parsha of Mei Meriva. It's hard to reach Parsha Chukas and not say something about the Mei Meriva, even though the Parsha is unclear. This is Perek Kaf. It's not clear what happened, not explicated. What is clear is that something happened, something extremely significant, whose implications would reverberate for many generations, but possibly even until our time. And there's many different approaches. We must have cleared the 30 already between the Rishonim and the Achronim. The Meshech Chochma has a certain approach to the Mei Meriva. And let us follow him, see what he says. What we do see, and now we're in Perek Kaf of our Parsha, is that Hashem is very insistent that Moshe speak to the rock. That is how the water is to be drawn out. That's in Pasuk Ches. It has to be through speaking to the rock. Why? And moreover, the Pasuk emphasizes, not only speak to them, but le'enehem, in their view. The people need to see you speaking to the rock. That's also very important. Why is it important? Says Meshech Chochma, the episode of Mei Meriva is actually a continuation or another round of the most important episode or event in our formative history. And that is Ma'amad Har Sinai. When we stood at Har Sinai, originally entering into the covenant with Hashem, and we said Na'aseh V'Nishma, and so on. That's when our relationship was cemented, in some respects, activated. And what does the Pasuk say there? Just how profound was the experience, or how impactful on us? The Pasuk says that the people were Roim es HaKolos. That's how it's described in Parshas Yisro. We read it not too long ago in Shavuos. On Shavuos. Roim es HaKolos. They saw the sounds. And Chazal are emphatic on this point. It literally means they saw the sounds. As if to say, which is hard for us to, it's a kind of a synesthesia, whereby sights are seen and sounds are heard, but at that level, they could actually see the sounds, and it's the sound of Hashem's voice. And to be able to see it gives an absolute fusion and connection with Hashem's word, and that's what we needed as the relationship began. Mei Meriva, says Meshech Chochma, is a redoing, a renewing of Ma'amad Har Sinai. This is a new generation. Many of these people were not at Har Sinai, not alive at Har Sinai. They're about to enter the land of Israel. It wasn't meant to take 40 years, but it has. So this generation that's about to enter the land of Israel, they need another round of, another iteration of Ma'amad Har-Sinai in order to get them ready to enter the land of Israel in the optimum way, with an optimum connection with Hashem. And that is why Moshe specifically needs to speak to the rock. As we know, in mitzvah purposes, when Moshe speaks, Hashem is speaking through him. Shechina medaberes mitoch grono. So they're about to once again encounter Hashem's voice, but it's le'einehem. It's something that they will see. What is that reminiscent of? Roim es hakolos. As Hashem speaks through Moshe, people will be able to see it, le'einehem. And that, in addition to the water that they need, that experience will now secure their spiritual level for entering the land of Israel. There's just one thing. Har-Sinai did not happen just like that. What we experienced at Har-Sinai required extensive preparation. Aside from what we know about the 49 days of the Omer, but you have those 2 or 3 days that the people are preparing intensively for Ma'amad Har-Sinai. Here we're saying there's another round. Obviously, it's not exactly the same, but there will certainly need to be some type of preparation. It will need to be expedited significantly because they need water. So they don't have 2 or 3 days to prepare, but there has to be some type of preparation. Otherwise, they have no affinity for what's about to happen. And part of Moshe's job is to make sure, is to see to it that that happens, to ready the people to see Hashem's voice. Roim es hakolos. Unfortunately, when Moshe meets the people, he sees them in a mode that is so antithetical to being prepared for any great spiritual experience. Moshe feels it's not going to work. They come, they're contentious, they're complaining. This is the antithesis of purifying themselves. And that's why Moshe judges the people as being beyond reach of what was meant to happen here. And that's why he calls them morim, they're rebellious, etc. And Meshech Chachma emphasizes, and we shouldn't need him to emphasize, but he does emphasize, we can never really fathom what's going on with in the mind of Moshe Rabbeinu. And to presume as to what's happening behind his judgments. But we need to understand as best we can that Moshe judges the people that nothing good will come of this. If he speaks, they're not going to see it. They're the opposite of prepared. There's no orientation towards an elevating experience. All they're doing is complaining. And that's why he calls them morim. And in the end, he doesn't even speak to the rock. He feels it will be a waste of time. He'll be wasted on them. And a wasted opportunity is worse than no opportunity at all. And what is the result of this? So to understand on a national level, the Jewish people thus did not experience the redo of Ma'amad Har-Sinai, the renewal of Ma'amad Har-Sinai, on the eve of them entering into Eretz Canaan. And if that's true, they entered on a lower level. Their connection with Hashem was not as fast as it should have been, not as secure as it should have been, and all types of mishap are thus possibly about to happen. And thus we understand the historical fallout from the May Meriva. It could have taken the Jewish people to a higher point of entry into the land of Israel, and the higher the point of entry, the greater the longevity. But they entered at this lower level. And thus, Moshe's punishment is that he can't go in with them. And Hashem says to him, Yan lo he'emantim bi, which Meshech Chachma says, as we know, it can always go two ways. You didn't believe, he'emantim is causative. You didn't promote belief in me, which you would have done had you spoken to the rock. You felt that the people were incompatible, but you should have made them compatible. And again, it's impossible for us to know why Moshe felt that would be a hopeless venture. But the impossible is demanded of Moshe Rabbeinu. Here they are complaining and so on. And Moshe's job is to, within momentarily, to turn the whole thing around and make them ready for a sublime and exalted spiritual revelation. Moshe felt that it couldn't be done. HaKadosh Baruch Hu held Moshe, the greatest of all, to the higher standard. So these are very interesting comments and insights with regards to Mei Meriva as presented by Meshechah. Let's conclude by taking a look at a group of three psukim. There's so much in Chukas, and it's between the Paradum and the Mei Meriva that it's sometimes hard to find time for other things. But the beginning of Perek Kaf Aleph. So we've seen Perek Yutes in Paraduma, Perek Kaf is Mei Meriva, Kaf Aleph, the first three psukim. And we'll read the psukim because it's a self-contained episode. Vayishma Knani Melech Arad Yoshev HaNegev, the Knani, the king of Arad, who dwells in the south, he heard Kiva Yisrael Derech HaAsarim, that the Jewish people were coming by way of the Asarim. We'll leave that term untranslated just for the moment. Vayilachem Yisrael, he waged war against them. Vayish B'menu Shevi, and he actually was able to take captive or captives from among them. So the Jewish people are not going to leave them behind. And they made a vow. It's the famous neder of the Jewish people. Vayidar Yisrael neder Lashem Vayomar. They made a vow and said, if you will deliver this nation into my hands, v'acharamti asareihem. V'acharamti means, as Rashi explains, we will consecrate all of their property to on high. Pasuk Gimel, v'yishma Hashem b'kol Yisrael. Hashem heard their voice, v'yitenes ha'kanani, and he delivered the Kanani into their hands, v'acharem eshem v'asareihem, and they indeed conquered and consecrated all of them and their cities, Vayikra Shem HaMakom Charma, and they called the place Charma. Now, what is the background to this war? And it's not a decisive victory or defeat. It's a temporary setback, which they then redress, which is very interesting. It's kind of it's in the middle. It's not a binary or exclusively victorious or loss. Abarbanel says, the background is really the death of Aaron that was mentioned before. With the death of Aaron, they're lacking in merit. And thus they were more susceptible. It sounds like, with the passing of a tzaddik, the Jewish people are more prone to damage. It sounds like they should have sustained a defeat, but they didn't. It was a temporary setback, but no more. But why is that? Didn't Aaron go missing? Says that Abarbanel, yes. But see how the people reacted to his loss. In the psukim that precede, Pasuk Kafches of Perek Kaf is the death of Aaron, and then Pasuk Kaftes, by Ukala Eda, Ki Gava Aaron. The people saw that Aaron had passed away, by Yivkues Aaron Shloshim Yom. They cried for him. Kol Beis Yisrael, the whole house of Israel. They all mourn for him. So Aaron is gone. There's nothing they can do about that. And life is not the same. And they're without his zechuyos, but not completely without. What allows them to maintain their connection with Aaron and maintain the access of the merit of Aaron that they mourned his passing? That is their own merit. And therefore, as much as they're not exactly as they used to be, they're able to recover. If the war captives are taken, they're able to get them back. This king hears that the people are coming Derech Ha'atarim. What is Derech Ha'atarim? So the classic understanding is that it refers to the way of the spies, meaning he sees that the Jewish people are entering the land the way the spies entered, following the same path. Ha'atarim are the spies, because Atarim is basically Tarim, like V'yosuru as Eretz Kanan. So Ha'asarim is Ha'atarim, Ha'asarim. The Aleph is extra, which can happen. We find in the Navi as well. Biyad Chazaka, Uve Ezroa Netuya, as well as many other places. In each time, it will need to be explained why there is an extra Aleph, but it doesn't change the essential meaning of the word. So Derech HaAsarim means first they sent the spies, and now they're following as a people in that trail, meaning they're about to invade. And therefore, he goes out to war against them. One of the Rishonim, Rabbi Shlomo Ishtaruk, explains that the Jewish people entering the land derech ha'atarim by in the way of the spies is not just geographically the trail. Apparently, what this king heard is that the Jewish people are entering the land in the way that the spies entered the land, namely, surreptitiously, without fanfare, without looking to draw attention to themselves. Now, if spies do that, well, naturally, because they don't want to be noticed or... But if a nation does that, says Rav Ishtaruk, he took that as a sign that they were scared. They don't want anyone to notice them because they don't have the wherewithal to deal with any opposition. If that's true, he became the opposition. There's nothing that will embolden an inhabitant nation of the land of Israel to wage war against the Jewish people than thinking that they don't want war. And therefore, derech ha'asarim doesn't just mean geographically the trail of the spies, but derech ha'asarim means in the same manner of the spies. They're entering spy-like, so then they're underconfident, presumably underprepared, undertrained, and they are vulnerable. And thus, he went out to wage war against them. Maril Diskin, moving on a number of centuries, the Maril Diskin, or Rishutei Diskin, explains the word atarim, again, asarim, not related to the word tarim, like spies, but to the word atar. Now, atar, we know, means a location, a place, more in Aramaic, but the connection between Hebrew and Aramaic is very steady. So we say, like Asra, Marada Asra. So derech atarim means, what did he hear? He heard that the Jewish people, they're entering the land, but they're staying close to established places, to atarim. Until now, they've been in the middle of nowhere, and they've been doing just fine, because they've been sustained by miracles. But apparently now, they need to be close to civilization in order to take care of themselves. That means that their miraculous mode is waning, is abating. And therefore, reasons the Kanani, Melech Arad, if they no longer have that miraculous protection, as is evidenced by the fact that they're constantly entering Derech Ha'atarim, maintaining contact with established civilized places, wherever they can, places of civilization. So then, once again, he took that as a sign. Divine protection is lowered for them, and therefore he fancied his chances of war against them. In fact, this idea that he sees or hears that their level of protection is lower is actually mentioned in the Gemara. And once again, it's a juxtaposition of this war with the death of Aaron. We know that the merit of Aaron was instrumental, or the conduit through which we received the Anane HaKavod, the clouds of glory, which had a protective aspect to them. But when Aaron passed away, the clouds of glory went away. The Gemara says they came back, but not straight away. And that's what he heard. And therefore, it's very similar, really, to Derech HaAsarim, in that they no longer have the clouds of glory. So now he thinks he will be victorious against them. Rashi quotes that Gemara on our Pasuk. Vayishma Knani, he heard that Aaron died, and there's no Anani HaKavod, and he thought now they're vulnerable. The Ramban here takes issue with Rashi. After all, if you look at Pasuk Aleph, read Pasuk Aleph, it says, Vayishma Knani Melech Arad Yoshev HaNegev, Kiva Yisrael Derech HaAsarim. The Pasuk tells you what he heard. The Pasuk explicitly states, he heard that they're coming Derech HaAsarim, which means there doesn't seem to be room or a niche for us to wonder, what does he hear? The Pasuk spells out what he heard. So why do we add in this other idea that he heard that there's no Anani HaKavod, and the words are directly geared towards what follows, which is the path that the Jewish people are following. And that's Ramban's question on Rashi bringing this idea. Now you might say, well, what about the Gemara? I mean, the Gemara says it. Unless we respond, well, that's the Gemara, but Rashi shouldn't have brought it out there at Hapshat. Ramban says no. The Gemara's comment about this whole situation, that when it says that he heard, it means he heard that there's no Anani HaKavod. That comment wasn't said on this pasuk. It was said on a later description of this war. Where do we find a later description of this very same war? In Parshas Maaseh. In Perek Lamed Gimel, where we have the 42 journeys of the Jewish people in the wilderness, Perek Lamed Gimel, Pasuk Mem. For the main part, it's Vayisu from here, Vayachanu here. Moves very quickly. But it digresses to talk about the death of Aaron. And then in Pasuk Mem, it says, Vayishma haknani melech harad, v'yasheber etz bedege v'etz kanan, v'voyisua. He heard. But it doesn't say what he heard. Ah. Now, says Ramban, you understand why there's room for the Gemara to step in. In our Pasuk, in Chukas, it tells you what he heard. He heard that they're coming derech Hasaran. But in the later Pasuk, it just says that he heard. It doesn't really explicate what he heard. So the Gemara says, he heard that Aaron had died. And therefore Ramban has no issue, so to speak, with the Gemara's exposition, but he feels that that is appropriate for the Pasuk in Parshas Maaseh. His issue is with Rashi addressing or adducing that drush of the Gemara in Parshas Chukas. So as we know, no one keeps a closer eye on Rashi than the Ramban. But we have this war, originally a setback. People are captured, or Rashi says one person was captured, a maidservant was captured. Doesn't matter. No one is just abandoned, and they wage war against it, and they call the place Charma. Where does all this happen? And we may add, where and when does all this happen? And what is the background to this question? Our pasuk refers to this king as he's a Knani, which kind of could mean anything. Melech Arad, he's the king of Arad. Where is that? We don't know. Yoshef HaNegev, he dwells in the south. So now we know it's in the south. But more than that, we don't know. What is the background to this inquiry? The Jewish people are currently on the east side of the Yarden. They're not going to go until after Moshe passes away. So they're on the east side of the Yarden. Where is Arad? Our pasuk, we don't know. It just says it's in the south. It could be on the southeast, or maybe on the southwest. We don't know. But if you look elsewhere, says Ramban, you'll find out where Arad is. Firstly, if you look in Sefer Yehoshua, in Perek Yud Beis, you will see that one of the cities that's conquered in Yehoshua's time on the west side of the Yarden is called Arad. We assume it's the same Arad. Moreover, says Ramban, we mentioned just a moment ago that this war is described not only in our parsha, but described again in Maaseh. Now, in our parsha, it just says that he was in the Negev, this king. Interestingly, there's an additional detail in Parshas Maaseh. If we read the pasuk again, Perek Lamed Gimel, pasuk Mem, Vayishma Knani Melech Harad. And where does he live? V'hu Yoshev Benegev, Be'eretz Kanaan. In Parshas Maaseh, the Torah specifies he lives in Eretz Kanaan. Says Ramban, never is the east side of the Yarden called Eretz Kanaan. It may have the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael in some respect, in an extended sense, but it's never called Eretz Kanaan. And here we see that king lived in Eretz Kanaan. Moreover, these cities are conquered. In a couple of Parshas' time, the conquered territories are going to be given to the 2.5 tribes. And who are the conquered territories? What are they? The lands of Sichon and Og. What about the land of the king of Arad? And don't say, says Ramban, well, they were machrim. It sounds like they completely destroyed the place. Ramban agrees with Rashi. Machrim means they consecrated the possessions of that place, but the land itself is habitable. There's never a mention of the territory of Arad on the east side. And that is why, says Ramban, in my understanding, this king lived on the west side of the Yarden, in Eretz Canaan proper, as we find the city of Arad is in Sefer Yehoshua, and we find the Parshas Maaseh calls him living in Eretz Canaan. And that's why it says, Vayishma, he heard, meaning he didn't see it, because there, still, the Jewish people are on the east side. He's on the other side. He hears that they're coming. And therefore he goes out to the east side of the Yarden to wage war with them. The question is, when they conquer his cities and rename it, where is his cities? If he lives on the west side of the Yarden, in Eretz Canaan itself, and they conquer his cities, that means that they are conquering territory in Eretz Canaan. But they're on the east side of the Yarden. How does that work? Says Ramban, in my understanding, the Pasuk here is giving us the whole picture, even though some of this would not happen for a number of years. We will find in the beginning of Sefer Shoftim that they conquered territories in Arad and called them Chorma. Says Ramban, that's even after Yeshua's time. That's what our Pasuk is referring to. Meaning, Pasuk Gimel now is an amazing situation. It's what's called Al Shem HaOsid, meaning the Torah describes some of what happened at the time and is already describing things that would happen later on. The counter war and retrieving of the one that was taken captive, that happened there and then. But the balance of Pasuk Gimel, calling the place Chorma, that's something which would not happen till much later on. That's a great chiddush of Rambam, invoking the concept of Al Shem HaOsid. For further details, consult Sefer Shoftim Perek Aleph. But that's already what's being referred to, previewed here. Al-Derech Nevuah. The Malbim, one might say, takes a more straightforward approach in the sense that he understands, he cites all of the sources that the Mefarshim have brought, east side, west side, and says, the Malbim, my understanding is that there were kings that had cities and territories on both sides of the Yarden. And that we find, by the way, the Emori is one of the seven nations of Eretz Canaan, but Sichon Melech Emori is on the east side. So we find the Emori, for example, has territories on both sides. So too does the king of Arad. And therefore, says the Malbim, in our Parsha, when it says that they conquered the place and they called it Chorma, that's referring to the places on the east side. Later on, Sefer Shoftim, when they entered and also called places Chorma, that's going to be on the west side. So these are two, it's two installments of the same thing, but whatever is described in our Parsha happened now, and whatever in Shoftim obviously happened later on. But a big chiddush comes from the Abarbanel, and with this, if there's no shiur next week, it's only because we have 2 weeks to recover from what the Abarbanel is about to say. And that is, he agrees in principle that if you talk about the king of Arad, if he's in one place, that's where he is. If it's true that he's on the west side of the Yarden, that's where he is. But he does not agree with Ramban's approach that the Torah is already telling us about things that will happen later on. Rather, says Abarbanel, this king of Arad is on the west side of the River Jordan. The Jewish people are on the east side. He goes, crosses the Jordan to the east side to wage war with them. But when they wage a counter war, they crossed the Jordan and they waged war with him on the west side of the Yarden, in the city of Arad. And they recalled it, and they called it Chorma at that time. They took his cities there and then, not all of them, but whatever they took those cities there and then. What is happening here? What is the Rabbi now saying? The very first military confrontation that we had in the land of Canaan itself was not Jericho, was not Jericho. It was Arad. Already here, we didn't conquer the place. We laid it waste, called it Chorma, and then came back. A few generations later, in the beginning of Shoftim, we'd actually then possess the place and call the whole place Chorma. But if you're looking, for, as far as that Barbalel is concerned, for the very first time we crossed the Yarden and waged war in the land of Canaan, do not wait for Sefer Yeshua. It's in Parshas Chukas, in the city of Arad. That's certainly one for the books. And with that, we will finish our discussion for this evening. We saw the Paraduma, the Mei Meriva, the Eretz Canaan, the west side and the east side. Certainly a lot to keep us thinking and contemplating. We'll leave it over there for this evening and meet again in Mitzvah Hashem. In 2 weeks' time, we should all have a Seiros Tovos, Yeshua, Svenachomos, Meshavua Tov, all the best.